Good morning, everyone, and I should also say good afternoon, everyone, since I'm not sure when you will be viewing this video sermon. It is my turn to record the quarterly sermon that we send out to all the congregations, and I've selected a topic that I certainly hope you will be interested in, you will find inspiring and helpful. It's a topic that I've been very interested in for my entire ministerial career. That covers more than 45 years now, 45 years this past year. So it's been a long time. I've studied it. Sometimes my efforts have been more intense than at other times. I've spent actually years in researching and studying this particular topic at various times. And then there years will go by when I certainly don't have the time or really the opportunity to do any more study. The subject I've chosen is church history. And I know there are many that are interested in church history. Maybe some aren't all that interested in history, but I believe it's a very important topic. It's a topic that you could give a series of sermons on. In fact, to think that in one sermon I could cover the subject of church history is really a foolish idea, because you really can't do that. But I hope to tell you a story today, a story of a little slice of the history of the church over the past from the past 2,000 years. I find it enlightening. I find it encouraging, and I hope you will as well. You know, the modern church has written on the subject of church history and spoken on the subject of church history going quite a ways back. In fact, if you go back to the Church of God Seventh Day, there was a book written in 1936 titled A History of the True Religion, traced from 33 AD to date. And that was written by Clarence O. Dodd, or C. O. Dodd, and Andrew N. Duggar, or known as A. N. Duggar as well. They wrote this book in 1936. Now, in 1933, the Church of God Seventh Day split into two parts here in the United States, the Stanbury portion, as well as and then, of course, the Salem, West Virginia portion. C. O. Dodd and A. N. Duggar were part of the Salem, West Virginia branch. And they wrote this book to document church history. From the time of the New Testament, they started in 33 AD, going all the way up to the modern day. Again, that was written in 1936. And then in 1959, in the Radio Church of God, Herman Hay wrote a booklet that became quite well known in the church called The True History of the True Church. There are probably many of you that remember that particular booklet. Also, the Radio Church of God published what was called the Ambassador Bible Study Course, Ambassador College Correspondence Course, the official name. And the original lessons of that, or at least the original issue, the 58-lesson course, there were other courses in later years, had a section on church history in it. There are actually, I believe, six or seven lessons covering the same pattern that Dr. Hay had covered in The True History of the True Church. That is, going through the seven churches of Revelation. And that was the Ambassador College Correspondence Course. And again, both those, the booklet and the correspondence course, were based upon the seven churches of Revelation. Then there was a series of articles in the early 1990s in the Plain Truth magazine. I actually wrote the part 10 of the series, which was titled The Sabbath Comes to New England. And that would have been in October of 1991. Well, that's over 30 years ago. And I'm happy to say that recently, in fact, last year, the Church of God, a worldwide association, wrote our booklet, or we had our booklet written. David Trabig was the primary author of the booklet, titled, Where is the Church Jesus Built? And chapter 4 in this booklet actually is titled, God's Church Through the Ages. So this is really our most recent effort on the subject of church history. But if you look back over the last 30 years, there's not been a lot written, nor has there been a lot said. And as I said today, I hope to enlighten you on this subject, to provide some material for you, and to tell you a story. I have a personal story about my study on a particular section of church history, basically dealing with the Sabbath as it arrives, or the Sabbath keepers who came over from England and established the first Sabbath-keeping church in Newport, Rhode Island. And I'd like to tell you their story, and kind of a side story is how I came across some of this material. I do have some unique things to provide, material that either doesn't exist anymore, Certainly my material is my personal material that I collected. And I've allowed other Church of God groups to use my material over the years, some of the slides that I have, some of the pictures that I can provide, because you can't reproduce them. They're not reproducible because the places either no longer exist or you can no longer get access to them. I had a very unique opportunity to have access to so much material, and I was able to collect it during a very specific period of time. And I want to tell you that story of how that came about, as well as filling you in on some of the more important parts of the story, the people, the names of people. I hope today to put flesh on the bones, so to speak, to describe individuals who've gone before us. You know, I get inspired when I read Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, because it describes people that went before the New Testament church. And what they endured, and how so many of them were persecuted and died even because of what they believed. Well, I believe there is just as much to be told about those who came before us, those that were the faithful individuals during the last 2,000-year history of the church. And I want to talk about some of those today. Again, it'll be a very small slice of that history, because there just isn't enough time in one sermon or even a series of sermons to tell the full story. I'd like to begin this journey by going back to the book of Revelation. I want to provide some background material before I get to the actual story that I want to tell you today. You know, the book of Revelation has to be the most unusual book that John wrote, maybe one of the most unusual books in all of the Bible. John wrote the book of John, the Gospel of John. He also wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. Now, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John are general letters that go to the church and just to the church. They're not aimed at a specific church or a congregation. But Revelation is very different. Revelation is prophetic. We understand that. We believe that. John was on the Isle of Patmos where he was imprisoned, and he had visions, and he was told to write them down. Just look at a couple of references here in Revelation chapter 1. Revelation 1, and let's take note of verse 1. Notice that this is a book, again, about the future. It says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants things which must shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John." Now, notice that it says shortly take place. In the margin, you'll find, at least in the New King James, it says quickly or swiftly. Our understanding of that is when these things begin to happen, it wasn't that they were going to happen very soon after John, although some things did, but that when they begin to happen, it'll all come together very quickly. But it's for the future. It's a prophetic. Look at verse 3. It says, "Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near." So again, it refers to this as a prophecy. Verse 4, we find who the prophecy is directed to. "John, to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits who are before his throne." So the message is written to these seven churches. And then notice verse 10. It says, "I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day." So John is in vision transported to the day of the Lord. Again, the end time. "And I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet." So this is the setting for what's going to be written in Revelation by John and what's recorded. And then notice verse 19. It says, "Write the things which you have seen and the things which are and the things which will take place after this." So there are three very important things to take note of. Revelation includes the things that John saw in vision and the things which are really in reality of that day. And the things which will take place after this are prophetic things. So all of that's included in the book of John. And then in chapters 2 and 3, we have a description and a warning to the church down through the ages. We believe these seven churches, they were seven churches in a mail route. You know, there had to be some reason why John selected these seven churches. These seven churches were on a mail route in Asia Minor. You know, there are many other churches that could have been selected. They could have all benefited from John's message. Thessalonica, Corinth, Colossae, Philippi, any one of these certainly could have benefited from what John wrote. Why these seven churches? And it appears to be dealing with the fact they were in a mail route and that the mail flowed and was delivered from Ephesus and goes all through the other six churches after that, or six cities where the churches were, and ending up in Laodicea. So there seems to be a reason for that. Our view of Revelation 2 and 3 is that we should take as a direct warning to the congregation. Take it at face value, written to these congregations. But also, because it's really difficult to imagine these churches so close to one another would have such diverse warnings given to them. It just seems a little strange that that would be. So our view is that this describes the church, warnings for the church, issues and problems the church will deal with down through the ages. And it is chronological, beginning with Ephesus during the time of the founding of the church and all the way to Laodicea, which will be the end time. Only two of these seven churches receive no correction. That would be Smyrna, called the persecuted church, and of course Philadelphia, the faithful church. So of the seven, only those two escape any sort of warning or any sort of correction. They're all warned, but any sort of correction. The New King James Version has titles over each one of these sections, and sometimes they're interesting, and sometimes they're of value, and sometimes they aren't. For Ephesus, it has the loveless church. For Smyrna, the persecuted church. For Pergamos, the compromising church. For Thyatira, the corrupt church. For Sardis, the dead church. For Philadelphia, the faithful church. And Laodicea, the lukewarm church. So these seem to be the characteristics of the warning message given to each of these churches. Now, again, we view them as being chronological, describing the church down through the ages. But in fairness, we also find that the last three churches, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, appear to be all in existence at the end time, as the way John writes, waiting for the return of Jesus Christ. So we have these qualities, a dead church, as it's called, the faithful church, and also the lukewarm church. So can we not say that these three qualities or these three warnings certainly are important for us at the end time? Now, all of them are important. But the fact of dying spiritually, we must prevent that from happening. We're warned about that. To be faithful, which we're also admonished about that. And then, of course, not to become lukewarm. Those things are certainly obvious. We're not the only ones that see the seven churches of Revelation in this light as being a chronological laying out of the history of the church, the story of the church, you might say. John Woolford, who wrote The Revelation of Jesus Christ, a commentary on Revelation, has this to say about that approach. He says, many expositors believe that in addition to the obvious implication of these messages, the seven churches represent the chronological development of church history viewed spiritually. They note that Ephesus seems to be characteristic of the apostolic period in general, and the progression of evil climaxing in Laodicea seems to indicate the final state of apostasy in the church. The order of the messages to the churches seems to be divinely selected to give prophetically the main movement of church history. As I said, that is our teaching. That's what we agree as being the way Revelation is laid out. It is prophetic. It does talk about the, you know, we can call them eras. We've done that before. We have to be careful that it's very difficult to have a specific date or year when one stage or one era of the church began and ended and then another one began. That's very difficult because there's certainly a lot of overlap. These things happened gradually over years and didn't just abruptly say, well, one year we have one era or stage and then the next year we have a new one. That's very, very difficult. But that gives you a little background to our study and belief of church history and how we look at it. And that's important, I believe, that we understand that in that particular approach. But now I'd like to tell you a story. This is a personal story of mine. I've told it many times before. No doubt some of you will have heard it before. I teach it each year at FI, Foundation Institute. But I want to share it with the entire church. And this is one way of doing that. Well, it was in the early 1980s when my story begins. It was at that time that I received a phone call from the headquarters of the Worldwide Church of God. I was a local pastor at that time, serving in Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston, Massachusetts. And I received a phone call. And the phone call was very short, actually, but asked me to do a number of things that started me on a journey that literally lasted for certainly for the next 4 years and very intensely, and then on and off for the last 45 years of my ministry, or 40 plus years of my ministry. This has been a very important topic for me. But I received a phone call from Pasadena, and I was asked to prepare some material, to do some research in preparation for what was going to become a feast video, a behind the work video that the church was producing, and that film crews would be coming out maybe 3 or 4 months after the phone call. And I was to do some research in advance of that. I was asked to do certain things. I was asked to find the location as best I could. Where the individuals who were part of the very first Sabbath-keeping church in New England would have lived, where they're buried, and their homes, if I could find them, as well as, of course, any meeting houses that still existed from going back, almost 200, well, over 200 years at the time. The location of the first Sabbath-keeping church in America was Newport, Rhode Island. Now, consider this, and this will be an overriding theme of the rest of my presentation, that rather than being able to identify everyone as a member of the true church, and keep that in mind, everyone as a member of the true church, that it's the thread of the church going through this. In other words, the Sabbath is a key issue. We're told the Sabbath is a sign of God's people. It's not the only sign, but it's a sign. And that by following the trail of the Sabbath, we're going to find God's people in there. That doesn't mean that every Sabbath keeper is a member of the true church, but every member of the true church is going to be a Sabbath keeper. That's our belief. That's what we see in Scripture, and we believe that. And so we search for the church based upon that, at least to some degree. It's not the only thing we look for. So what I'll be presenting to you in my story of the people that I found and the research I did is that among these people would be the thread of the true church, following it consistently from obviously the New Testament period all the way through Europe, all the way through England, and of course to America. And that's the important thread that we're going to follow today. So I want to take you on that journey today. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 2. I do want to emphasize the point I just made about not declaring. That's not my point, to declare every single individual to have been a part of the true church of God just because they kept the Sabbath, but that, again, as I said already, that all of the members of the true church of God will be Sabbath keepers. 2 Timothy chapter 2 puts it this way, and I think this is a good way for us to say it here at the beginning. 2 Timothy 2, verse 19 says, "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." So God knows those who are his. We may not be able to identify them, but God knows them. And rather than spending our time trying to say, well, did this person have all of the truth, or do they only have a part of the truth? We're going to deal with the Sabbath as the overriding sign and issue and follow that thread. And with that disclaimer of where we're going to go. But let's go ahead and begin the story of what I discovered. And that story really has its roots in a particular verse. Let's go to Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. I think you're all familiar with this particular verse, Matthew 16, verse 18. In Matthew 16, verse 18, we have a prophecy by Jesus Christ. Everyone may not recognize it as a prophecy, but we certainly do. He makes a very dogmatic statement. Notice what he says, Matthew 16, verse 18. It says, "And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Now, Hades is a Greek word that actually means the grave or grave. So what Christ is saying, he looks to Peter. He says, "You're Peter." Now, we know that Peter was also named Cephas, which means a stone. You know, you're a little pebble, you're a stone. And on this church, Christ points back to himself. I believe if we could have been present there at that time, we would see him point back to himself. "On this rock, I will build my church." And notice he goes further and he says, "The grave will not prevail against it." So we believe that that prophecy is being fulfilled today. That the church of God, however small it may be at times, is going to exist. You know, church meaning a group of people. The church is the people. It's not a building or anything of that nature. Will exist from the time it was founded on the day of Pentecost, we believe in 31 AD, all the way till the return of Jesus Christ. So the challenge isn't where the church, well, certainly it is where, but the challenge isn't whether the church would exist or not at any era of time, but where is it and how do we find it? We accept the fact that from the prophecy, it will always exist, but where will it be found? The other sign, and I've already made reference to this, that we look for, we find this stated in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 9. Hebrews 4, verse 9. I'm going to put this on the screen for you in from different translations. Notice, first of all, the King James translation says, "There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God." That's the King James translation. Other translations have it a little more direct. This is from the American Standard Version. "There remaineth therefore a Sabbath rest to the people of God." A Sabbath rest. The Greek word is sabbatismos. It's only used once in the New Testament, and all scholars that I know of recognize this as having a reference to the Sabbath. So it's not just you're tired, we rest at any time. It's resting on the Sabbath. And then, of course, this is in the Bible in basic English, so that there is still a Sabbath keeping for the people of our God. So it's not just a rest, it's a Sabbath rest, and it's also even more than a Sabbath rest, it's a Sabbath keeping for the people of God. So our desire, as we follow the story of the people of God down through the ages, that we follow it through the thread of the Sabbath. And I think that's very important. And I think that's, again, something that is a legitimate way to search and to follow through on this story. And that's, of course, what I plan to do here today. That's where I began back in the 1980s, and it's taken me on quite a journey over the years. So let's follow that journey that I took. You know, when I was at Ambassador College my freshman year, the second semester, we studied the book of Acts. And along with the book of Acts, we also studied church history. And that church history took us through the epochs of time and took us to Europe. You know, after the period of time in the Middle Ages, it's very difficult. The church is very hard to locate definitively. But then we come to, and this is where I'm going to pick up my story, we come to the Alpine region of southern France. And it's particularly a city in southern France called Lyon. And Lyon is near Switzerland, not that far from Germany, and it's a, obviously it's a city even today, but it was an important city. There are a lot of alpine valleys in that area. It's the sort of the French Alps are in that particular region. And in the Alps, there was a group of individuals that we can identify who kept the Sabbath. Now they're known by various names. Sometimes in history, they're called Waldenses or Waldensians, or they're called Valdez or Valdezians or Valdezans, I guess would be a better word. But again, the W and the V being interchangeable. Some say they were named after the valleys, you know, the Valdez valleys or valley that was there. Or some say they're named after Peter Waldo, who was a famous I believe he was in the Catholic Church. He left the Catholic Church, was very disgusted with the Catholic Church, and formed a group that were often called the Poor Men of Lyon, as the beginning of a group. They were heavily persecuted by the Catholic Church. We find that they were Sabbath keepers, although, again, please keep in mind that there is a Waldensian group today that exists, and they're Sunday keepers. And in fact, I've been in touch with some of those today, and they will insist that the Waldensians that they're a part of have always been Sunday keepers. And so that created a little doubt in some people's minds. Well, were these really Sabbath keepers? Keep in mind that all of the firsthand information about these people, the things that they wrote, were destroyed by the Catholic Church in the Spanish Inquisition. All the books were burned. So we have no firsthand written documents from them. We get our information from the Catholic Church and what they wrote about them. There is a book, actually it's a five-volume work called Heresiography. At one time we were told that this book was heavily quoted, Heresiography was heavily quoted in the booklet by Herman Hay, The True History of the True Church. Some will say, well, it never existed. You can't find copies of it today. And it is very difficult to find copies. But in my journey, I found a copy, the five-volume work of the Heresiography, and confirmed the statements written about the Waldensians by the Catholic Church and how they were accused of believing in the millennium on earth, They were accused of keeping the Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath. And there were other things they were accused of, becoming like the Jews, really. And that was anathema for the Catholic Church, and they were prepared to destroy these people. And many of them were killed. Because of that, in the 1500s, we don't know how it happened or actually exactly when it happened. But this group of individuals, some of them fled to England, where they were looking for safety because of the persecution in the Alpine regions. And basically, they were wiped out in the Alpine regions by the Catholic Church during the Spanish Inquisition. So they go to England. And what I put up on the screen now is a book, or actually a magazine that was published, actually going back to the 1800s. This is a copy of it from 1868. It's called The Sabbath Recorder. And in 1868, The Sabbath Recorder ran an article on church history. And here's what they said. They said, in 1552, many in England were known as Sabbatarians. So sometime between the persecution of the Spanish Inquisition and the year 1552, some of those Sabbatarians moved from southern France and show up in England. And they began to grow in England. They had an atmosphere that allowed them to grow. England had gone from being Catholic to being Protestant and allowed them to have a sort of a haven where they could be free. Now, it didn't last long, but for a while it was there. And they developed in that area. In fact, we know now, historically, we can confirm there were 11 Sabbath-keeping churches just around London. And we also have evidence back in the 1980s when I traveled and interviewed some of the oldest members of still the Sabbatarian groups that are there in southern Rhode Island, in the area of Westerly and Hopkinton, the area not so much around Newport anymore, but those areas. I was given books and material that told the story of the church and confirming that there were times, at least some of these churches around London actually kept the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. There are references to that. How prevalent it was, we really don't know. There aren't a lot of historical records to confirm much more than that. But we know that there were 11 churches in that area. So that's something that provides a location where people can go from the continent, from Europe, and have freedom of religion, at least to keep the Sabbath. Remember, the Sabbath identified God's people, the true church even, with the Jews. And there was a lot of persecution of the Jews, and the Sabbatarians were sort of lumped in that and ended up suffering greatly as well. So we have in the 1500s, middle of the 1500s, all of this taking place. There were pamphlets written about the Sabbath during this period of time. In 1595, there was a famous pamphlet written against the Sabbath keepers because they were becoming a bit more prominent. Even the royal physician to the king was a Sabbath keeper, and his last name was Stinnett, and the Stinnett family were famous Sabbath keepers in England. There were others along the way as well. Brayburn was another name of those who kept the Sabbath there that we know about, that we can read about. So they were okay there for a while, but things are going to change. Well, just as things are about to change in England, we find another development. This is sort of a sidetrack to the story because while a lot of people think, well, the New World is the place to go and to be able to enjoy freedom of religion. Well, that wasn't true. It seems to be not quite well known that the colonies in America were not at all friendly to different religions, especially in the Northeast, where you have those that were very stern and strict about their religion. The Puritans were there, and they were very strict and didn't allow much tolerance at all for someone who might have a different view. The Quakers were heavily persecuted. The Baptists were heavily persecuted, and the Sabbatarians were as well. So this is all going on. But there has to be a place. You know, England is becoming less accepting. So where will they go from there? Well, around this time, there was a fellow by the name of Roger Williams. Now, Roger Williams is one of the most interesting people that I've ever studied. Roger Williams was a maverick by all standards. He arrived in the New World in 1630. He arrives in Boston in 1630. And he was also seeking religious freedom. He wanted to be free to do as he believed was correct. He settled in Salem, actually, after arriving in Boston, and he became the pastor of a church in Salem. We don't know all of the difficulties, but he experienced a lot of difficulties with the members there, and he was actually run out of town is basically the best way of saying it. He was run out of town. I put on the screen a statue of Roger Williams. This statue stands overlooking the city of Providence, Rhode Island. And he's obviously was a very important person in Rhode Island. So from Salem, Roger Williams went down to Plymouth, Massachusetts, and pastored another church. Well, he lasted there only a few months, and they also had problems with him and demanded that he leave. Well, at this point, where would he go? Roger Williams crossed the Pawcatuck River and went over to what is today Rhode Island and what became the Rhode Island colony. He purchased a section of that area from the Indians, and then he established a settlement in Providence, what is today Providence, Rhode Island, the first settlement in what became the colony of Rhode Island in 1636. Well, now not only is there a place to go, but it's a place that guarantees freedom of religion. After all that Roger Williams went through, he was not about to turn anyone away because of their religion. So in the 1640s, Roger Williams went to England and obtained a charter. An actual charter, so that there were three different types of colonies during that period, based upon the type of charter you had. And so, Roger Williams sought a royal charter from the king. And this is what he put in his request for a charter. It says, now know you, and this is reproduced on the screen for you. This comes from some of the historical, books for the state of Rhode Island. It says, now know ye that we, being willing to encourage the hopeful undertakings and to secure them in the free exercise and enjoyment of all the civil and religious rights appertaining to them, no person shall hereafter be molested, punished, disquieted, or called in question for any difference in opinion in matters of religion who do not disturb the civil peace. Now, you may think, well, this should have been true at all the colonies, but it wasn't. Rhode Island is the first place in the New World where there's an absolute guarantee of religious freedom. This made it possible for the Baptists and the Quakers especially to flock into Rhode Island, where they could have safety to practice their religion. In Providence, Rhode Island today, there is a national park to Roger Williams, and this is his home. This is the sits in the park just north of the city of Providence. Actually, still today it's a part of the city of Providence. Now, this has been touched up. It's been repaired over the years, changed slightly, but this would be the home of Roger Williams. He was a very wealthy man and had a very nice home for the colony of Rhode Island. He became what he calls himself a seeker of truth all of his life. You know, if you look at the study of the Baptist Church, you'll find that Roger Williams is listed as the founder of the First Baptist Church in Rhode Island. Now, while that's true, remember Roger Williams' record, though. He only lasted a few months with the Baptist Church. He did begin the First Baptist Church in Rhode Island in 1638, actually. But there's some dispute of that, because Roger Williams, shortly after founding it, left the Baptists as well, and he became, for the rest of his life after that, what he called a seeker of truth, and not a part of any particular church, a seeker of truth. He did have friends who were Sabbath keepers. He had correspondence in the old records of his writings. At Roger Williams College in Rhode Island, there is a section of archives that have all of his writings, at least that they've preserved. And there's a letter in his writings written maybe a few years before he died to a Sabbath keeper by the name of Samuel Hubbard. And he writes to Samuel Hubbard. He says, "You almost convince me of the Sabbath and the festivals," which gives us a clue that at least there was some interest in the festivals as well among some of the Sabbath keepers. But Roger Williams said, "You didn't quite convince me." There's no record he ever accepted the Sabbath or ever accepted the festivals, but he was in contact with them. But Roger Williams, as I said, is given credit for founding the First Baptist Church in Providence. Now, this is the location of the First Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island. This picture I have on the screen. But now this is obviously not the building, the original building. This building was built in the 1800s. But this is the location where the First Baptist Church was in Rhode Island. And I want you to notice what it says on the well, it's the announcement plaque, I guess, or in the front of the building. This is what it says. Notice it says that this was founded by Roger Williams in A.D. 1638. Now, I'm going to explain to you why that's important as we go along. We're going to find that there is a dispute because at the same time Roger Williams is founding the First Baptist Church in Providence, there's another man by the name of John Clark who's founding the Baptist Church in Newport, Rhode Island. And they both claim to be the original one, and both claim the date of 1638. So it's virtually impossible to totally resolve this dispute, but I want you to know that at the same time that's happening, there's a First Baptist Church founded in Newport, Rhode Island as well. But Rhode Island became a haven for religious freedom. Notice what was happening in Boston. Here is a plaque that sits on Boston Common, the oldest park in America. Is there. That's the Boston Common. And this is what, there are plaques all around the Common in honoring certain dates in history. Notice this particular plaque. I took a picture of this many years ago about Mary Dyer. It says, Mary Dyer, Quaker, witness for religious freedom, hanged on Boston Common in 1660. So this is what was done to the Quakers and the Baptists as well. There's evidence. There's also a little island as you land in Boston Airport today. You'll go over a couple of little islands out in Boston Harbor. One of them is called Noodles Island, just a little piece of land. And there are the remains or the ruins of an old prison that was on that island. This is where many of the Sabbath keepers and many of the Baptists were sent and imprisoned in Massachusetts. So the colony in Massachusetts had little to do or little time for a Sabbath keeper, for a Baptist, or a Quaker. Those are the three primary ones that were persecuted. There was even one of the most famous Puritan ministers was a man by the name of Cotton Mather. And Cotton Mather wrote a rebuke of those who kept the Sabbath and wrote a rebuke of Roger Williams as well. Those that were persecuted in the Massachusetts Bay Colony at the time. Connecticut was no different. They also persecuted especially the Baptists and drove them out and did not allow for the Quakers either. So now the stage is set. We now have Rhode Island, though, the smallest of the colonies, or at least I'm not sure if it's a little bigger than Delaware or not, but it's pretty small. And here's the location in the New World where one can truly have freedom of religion. Again, you can imagine that those in England now who are suffering also a lot of persecution, they're going to end up there. You know, there's a reason why Stephen Mumford is going to end up in Rhode Island. And I believe, you know, that again, just as one door closes in an area, God does open another door and provide a place and a location for his people. I put up on the screen now an old pamphlet. One of the things that you find in England during this period of time in the 1600s, that whenever an event in public event would occur that people would take note of, they would write a pamphlet about it, just describing that particular event. This is a reproduction of a pamphlet that was produced in 1662, but it's describing the death of John James in November of 1661. Inside this pamphlet, it tells the story. John James was a Sabbatarian minister. Remember the 11 churches around London. He was in what was called the Newcastle Church, which was north of London. And he was preaching away on a Sabbath, and he was arrested. The royal guards rushed in. They took him off the stage. They took him across the street. They tried him and convicted him of treason. Now, why would he be convicted of treason? Well, during that period of time, there was a political group called the Fifth Monarchist. These were individuals. Remember Daniel 2, where you have the four kingdoms, and then in the statue in Daniel 2, and then you have the a fifth government or fifth kingdom, the stone that's cut out without hands and that strikes the image on its feet. So they call themselves the Fifth Monarchist, therefore the kingdom of God, and they're not loyal to the King of England. And they're only loyal to God. And so that allowed them to be accused of treason. And they were politically motivated. Well, John James was not a part of that. But because he also taught that there was coming a kingdom of God on earth, it wasn't the British Empire, he was dragged away, arrested. He was later hanged, and his body was quartered. That's what happened to John James. This is 1661. Note the timing. So now what will the Sabbath keepers in England do? Others were killed. This pamphlet says there are stories of others who were persecuted and even killed because of their belief. And again, this is aimed at the Sabbath keepers because of their teaching that the kingdom of God will be on earth. The British Empire is not the kingdom of God, and that caused many of them to be persecuted and some to be killed. So now what will they do? Well, again, after the reporting of the death of John James, that spread through all of the Sabbath-keeping churches, as you can imagine. And so now there is a desire, well, where will we go? Where can we find religious freedom? Remember, England went from being Catholic to being Protestant to back to Catholic for a short while and then back to Protestant. And during all of that time, whether it was Protestant or Catholic, they had no time for the Sabbath-keepers because they were being influenced by the Jews. And they did not want them. There was a lot of persecution. So now we find they've got to go somewhere. At least some of them do because of the intense persecution. So the door is now open in the New World for a location where they can actually have freedom of religion. And that's Rhode Island. So we shouldn't be surprised that in 1664, just 3 years after John James, Stephen Mumford, his wife Anne Mumford, their son Stephen Mumford, and their daughter Anne Mumford, all traveled to the New World, and they landed in Newport, Rhode Island. This wasn't an accident. This was by design. This was a place they knew they could go and keep the Sabbath, and that was very important to them. Also, the Baptists were there, the Quakers were there, persecuted groups of people were all there, and they were not being persecuted in that area. That was very important to them. Stephen Mumford was a fairly wealthy merchant. When he arrives in Newport, Rhode Island, and he begins his business there. As I said, their children were also named Stephen and Anne, and therein lies some of the confusion when you're studying the history of this as to which one you're speaking of. They didn't use the term junior. During that period of time, it was difficult for a child to reach adulthood. Many of them died as infants from disease or whatever. It was not easy settling in a new world or settling in the new world. So they would name their children the same name as themselves, hoping they would live and carry on the name. So therefore, you have Stephen and Anne Mumford, who had two children, Stephen and Anne. And again, there, as I said, lies some of the confusion. Now, Newport, Rhode Island, remember that the colony of Rhode Island, later, of course, today the state of Rhode Island, is actually a beautiful part of America. It has a beautiful coastline. There are islands. It is truly has an island connected to it and, of course, a mainland portion. There are really two distinct portions to the state of Rhode Island, in spite of the fact it's so small. There are the island portion, and then, of course, there is the mainland portion. The mainland portion is dominated by Providence as the main city. The island portion is dominated by Newport as the main city. So for many years, being a colony, one term the governor would be from Providence, and the next term the governor would be from Newport because of the dominance of these two cities. But it's a beautiful coastline. Here's a picture of the coastline of Rhode Island. Rhode Island was so beautiful, is so beautiful, that many of the wealthiest individuals, certainly in New York, built summer homes, actually looked more like castles, along the coast of Newport, Rhode Island. This is where they came in the summertime. You have individuals like the Rothschilds and the Fords and others who came there and built their summer homes. And it's quite impressive to drive along Ocean Drive, and this is a picture along Ocean Drive of the coastline of Newport. So not only was it an inviting place to go, it was a prosperous place to go. Of course, these are more modern pictures, but even when Stephen Mumford arrived, there was a certain prosperity. When Stephen Mumford arrived, Newport was a village of less than 1,000 people, but it was a productive and a wealthy area for even that size. And a lot of trade went on out of Newport Harbor back to England. As I said, it was a haven. Rhode Island was a haven for other religious groups. This is the old Quaker meeting house. This has been built on and added on over the years, but the original building was built in 1699. And this is the original building, at least part of it is still original. And it's where the Quakers could meet. And they could meet in peace and safety in Rhode Island. That wasn't true in other colonies. And so there is a place that I believe God did prepare where you could go and where the Sabbath keepers would not die out. They were dying out in England. They were being forced out in England. But now there's a place where they can go and actually prosper. And that's where Stephen Mumford and his family end up in 1664. Now, one other thing that I want to point out in Newport, Rhode Island, it's a beautiful city. I've told people one of my favorite cities in the whole world is Newport, Rhode Island. They've kept it more with a colonial atmosphere, and they have a lot of the old buildings. Here is the what's called the Red White Horse Tavern. It's the oldest tavern in America, built in 1673, and this is it today. This is no doubt where many of the Sabbath keepers gathered at times, had meals, had meetings in this particular place, because it was a number of years before they actually had a building in Newport. In fact, the first building built for Sabbath keepers in Newport, Rhode Island, wasn't until the 1700s, 1729 to be exact. So they would meet in homes and they would meet in various places and no doubt spent some time in the White Horse Tavern. And this is the picture of the White Horse Tavern. This is also the sign out front, identifying it as America's oldest tavern. And of course, was visited by many of the dignitaries of that period of time. So what we visited there, I'm kind of retracing the steps of some of these Sabbath keepers. And of course, this is along the trail that you follow in identifying who they are. Another place that offered a lot of help was the Redwood Library. In Newport, Rhode Island, this is the oldest public library in America, still active. And this is where I found the five-volume work of heresiography. It does exist. It does tell the story of the Waldensians from the Catholic perspective about their enemies. Very important to find this. I don't know if there's another copy anywhere else in the world. I've never located one. I found it here, though, in the Redwood Library. All five volumes are here. And it tells a story. That's very important. It was one of the criticisms of the old book of the True History of the True Church is that the heresiography doesn't exist. It was quoted by people who quoted other people who quoted other people, and there was no such book. Well, we found it. I found it at the Redwood Library in Newport, Rhode Island. Very important source of historical data. Now let's go back to the story of the First Baptist Church in Newport. Notice this sign in front of the building. It's today called the United Baptist Church, but it's the location of the First Baptist Church. And notice the date, 1638. Remember back the slide I showed you previously where Roger Williams, the First Baptist Church in Providence, claims the same date. So there's this ongoing battle as to which one was first. Was it the Baptist Church in Providence or was it the Baptist Church in Newport? And I don't know that anyone has ever resolved that. They both claim 1638 as a beginning. Here's a picture of the church today. This building was probably built in the 1700s or 1800s. But this is the location of this Baptist church. Now, why is that important? Well, when Stephen Mumford arrives in Newport, he's not a minister. He's a member of the Sabbatarian Church in England. So he wants to find a place to associate with people. And the Baptists were very welcoming, and their beliefs were some that he was certainly accustomed to. They kept an annual Passover, Lord's Supper. They washed feet. They believed in the millennium on earth. They actually believed in drinking as well. In other words, alcohol was not forbidden by the Baptists of this time. So Stephen Mumford and his family felt comfortable with these people to associate with them. There's no evidence he ever became a member of the church, but he attended with them on Sundays, kept the Sabbath at home by himself. Of course, that word got out, and there were other people that became convinced of the Sabbath and began meeting with him in his home. That's getting a little bit ahead of the story, but it's going to be a part of the story. Now, one of the other things that I was asked to try and find would be the graves of the individuals. The more relevant one, certainly the grave of Stephen Mumford and his family, as well as, if I could, to find his home as well. And so I wanted to find the home that Stephen Mumford may have lived in. That was very difficult. There were no historical records that I could find. I became really good friends with a lady that worked in the Newport Historical Society. Her name was Mrs. Bullhouse. And she would help me in finding some historical data. So one day I was telling her what I was looking for, and she said, well, you know, I believe back in the old records, if you go with me back to this, to the safe, we have this walk-in safe, we can go back there and see if we can't find something. She said, I believe we have the will of Stephen Mumford. And so she takes me back there, and sure enough, we found a manila folder that had on it will of Stephen Mumford. Now, unfortunately, it was Stephen Mumford the Younger, but it still had a home there listed as belonging to his father, Stephen Mumford. And this was a great revelation to me that as to where his home was. And it gave the location. It says so many rods from this particular point and so many rods from the harbor, and you will find the house. Well, I went and I walked off the distances that I was told in the will. And when I ended up, I came out in front of a museum, and it's called today the Wanton Lyman House. And I go into this museum. This is a picture of it from the 1920s. It's been refurbished and kept up. It's a museum in Newport, Rhode Island. Now, I was convinced this was Stephen Mumford's home. But the name of the home was called the Wanton Lyman Hazard House, named after the ones who had owned it. And now, of course, a museum. But I was convinced it was Stephen Mumford's home. So I go in and I tour the museum, and I can't find any evidence. I talk to individuals there. I talk to those back at the Newport Historical Society. There's no record of Stephen Mumford ever being associated with this building. But I was convinced it was true. And I made several visits there. And on one of my visits, I saw a young man with a pad walking around taking notes. And I went over and talked to him. And he said, oh, he was a student from Brown University, and he was doing his thesis on the Wanton Lyman Hazard House. And he said, you know, he said, I believe this house was actually built by Stephen Mumford. And I said, well, I do too. And so he and I compared notes, and he published his thesis and proved. They did some soundings. They did some samples from the beams that were in the house and redated the house and associated it with Stephen Mumford. So after that point, this would have been in the early 1980s, the museum changed their brochure and the material that they had about the museum. To today, it reads this way: the oldest surviving house in Newport, the Wanton Lyman Hazard House, was built for Stephen Mumford in 1697, or circa 1697. Mumford was a merchant and a founding member of Newport's Seventh-day Baptist congregation. Now, the term Seventh-day Baptist isn't going to actually be used for those people until more than 100 years later. They call themselves the Church of Christ Keeping the Commandments, or the Church of God. Those were the names they used for themselves. And notice it says, this house passed to Mumford's son, Stephen Mumford. That's how I located it in the will. And then was sold to Richard Ward, a lawyer who became governor of the colony of Rhode Island in 1741. During the Revolution, Ward's son Samuel also was elected to that office. So here we have the connection with the Wanton Lyman Hazard House being the actual home of Stephen Mumford. This was a great find, and it actually affected the historical record as given out by the museum there. So I felt very good about that finding it, but that was only part of my journey. Now I needed to find the graves of Stephen Mumford and his family. Where would they be? Well, now often, someone would be buried in their backyard. So I thought, well, maybe they're in the backyard. Well, this was a museum, and they wouldn't let me back there. So I said, well, that's not going to stop me. If you look at this side street, there's a side street beside the building. There's a fairly tall fence that goes around the back of it. They weren't going to keep me out. So I'm over that fence, and I'm looking for the grave, and sadly, fortunately, I didn't get caught, but sadly, there was no grave there. So I go back to Mrs. Bullhouse in the Newport Historical Society, and she says, well, you know, I think, you know, the old colonial cemetery may be the location of their graves. Says, you know, you can go down there and look and see. Well, I decide, well, I'm going to go down to the old colonial cemetery. It's the second oldest cemetery in America. And here's what I find. It's a conglomeration scattered about of all types of headstones and graves. It just goes all over the place. Well, I decided I had to find it. So for 2 days, I walked this entire cemetery looking and looking and looking, and I still could not find it. I actually discovered that there's a name for people who study headstones. It's called a taphophile. A taphophile, it comes from the Greek. It means a lover of graves. And this is what the name given to those who study headstones. And I became pretty proficient in studying headstones during this period and could identify from a distance within a few years of when a headstone was actually placed. And that helped me in trying to find these graves, but I just couldn't find them. So I'll go back to the Newport Historical Society. I tell Mrs. Bullhouse, well, I can't find it. She says, I think somewhere back in the vault, if you'll go with me, hidden away back there, there's an old vellum map. that are plat of all of the graves in that cemetery. Maybe we can find it that way. So sure enough, we go back, we pull it out, we lay it out. It's a vellum. It's very fragile, but we find the location of Stephen Mumford's grave and his family. And you see, I've marked it here on this map. Now I knew where to go. I could see in relation to the road, and I knew where to go to find it. So I go from there and go right back to the cemetery, and sure enough, I find the graves. Stephen Mumford's grave, his wife Anne, and I believe a couple of children are buried there as well. This is what it looked like on this particular day when I was there. We cleaned it up a little bit, got a better shot of it for our video, and this is what they look like. This is Stephen Mumford's headstone. Now, you'll notice, and by the shape of it, this is not from the 1600s. This is not from the early 1700s. This headstone was added much later, which also explains why on either side you have these pagan symbols. Now, remember, none of Stephen Mumford's family were ever a part of the church, just he and his wife. So you've got these this skull on the side, and you've got all this fruit on the side to provide, you know, food in the afterworld. Those type pagan things are on this headstone. But it wasn't put there by him, not even probably by his immediate family, because the dating of this headstone would be much later than the early 1700s when he died. This is what it says on his grave, though. "Here lieth buried ye body of Stephen Mumford, aged 68 years, and departed this life July 1707. And then next to him is his wife, Anne. And we find that it says, "This here lieth buried ye body of Anne Mumford, ye wife of Stephen Mumford, aged 63 years, deceased February 22nd, 1697/8. What's that all about? Did they not even know the year that she died? Here's a close-up of that so you can see that it's 97/8 or 7/8. Well, here's the story. Up until 1752, the British colonies were under the Julian calendar, and they didn't adopt the Gregorian calendar until 1751. The first year of the Gregorian calendar would have been 1752. The reality is that many of the dates of American history are suspect because depending on which calendar they use, especially those before 1752. So the Julian calendar began the year. New Year's Day in the Julian calendar was March 25th. So you can see that to die in February would have been in the Gregorian calendar, 1698, but on the Julian calendar, 1697. And so this also tells us that this headstone was put there well into the 1700s and not at the time of their deaths, which also, as I said, explains some of the pagan symbols that are here, which they would not have accepted. Now, as proof of that, here is another headstone. This is one of the more famous headstones in America. You find it in even magazines where people study these things. And it's the headstone of Roger Baster. He was one of the original seven members of the first Sabbath-keeping church in America in Newport, Rhode Island. He designed his own headstone. He was called a block maker. And notice what it says on his headstone. So just a simple stone, and it has the carvings on it, and you won't be able to read it off the headstone, but here's what it says. "Here lieth ye body of Roger Baster, bachelor, blockmaker, age 66 years, died the 23rd day of April, 1687. He was one of the first beginners of a Church of Christ observing of the Seventh-day Sabbath of the Lord in New England." Note that they weren't called the Seventh-day Baptists. History of the Seventh-day Baptist reads backwards. In other words, they take the term Seventh-day Baptist and read it backwards. But that was not what these people call themselves. They refused to have an official name because it meant state or government recognition. They call themselves the Church. Sometimes the Church of Christ, sometimes the Church of God, but most often just the Church. And later on, of course, toward the 1800s, the name was changed to Seventh-day Baptist. But then they apply that all the way back. Notice again that this was not the term that they used about themselves. I mentioned the Newport Historical Society. This is a picture of it. This is where I gained a lot of information. They have a museum here. They have books and archives where I found a lot of material. I went back into their vault with Mrs. Bullhouse and was able to get a lot of material to use over the years. Today, in the back of the Newport Historical Society is another building. And you see how it's been attached here. It was bricked up and attached. It was moved from its original location. And this is the oldest Sabbatarian meeting house in America. It was built in 1729. Now, there were buildings built before this. In 1680, there were some buildings. But this is the oldest one that still exists. And this is the building. Today, it's a museum. You'll notice that in the back of the building, or on the side of the building, actually, is where the entrance is. And this entrance is right behind the lectern, or behind the podium, which was attached to the wall. And this is pretty typical of the Sabbatarian meeting places. They would have it set up so that if you came late for church, you had to walk by the minister. And it's even noted in some of their old records. Inside this building, it's a beautiful building. They have the podium on the side of the building with the Ten Commandments behind it. And it was in 1671 that the Sabbath-keeping group met together. Not together for the first time. They were meeting in Stephen Mumford's home, but they met as a body, as a church, because the Baptist church had made it impossible for them to continue. One of the ministers at the Baptist church by the name of Obadiah Holmes gave a message in which he denounced the Sabbath keepers. At that time, there were seven of them. The Mumfords had already stopped attending because of the intensity of the persecution going on within the church. And the other five were still attending. But on this particular Sunday, Obadiah Holmes denounced them. And it says there was a tumult in the church. And then Obadiah Holmes said, well, we're going to have a meeting to discuss this issue this coming Thursday night in the church. And the five showed up. The pastor was there, John Clark. And he says, do you believe you should keep the Sabbath? And no one spoke up. The minutes record that Tacy Hubbard spoke up and said, yes, sir, we do. We believe we must obey God, not man. And it says there was another tumult that occurred in the church. And from that time on, they could no longer meet with the Baptists. So they formed the first Sabbath-keeping church in America. And it was formed there in Newport, Rhode Island, with seven members. These were the seven that formed that first church: William Hiscox, Stephen Mumford, Samuel Hubbard, Roger Baster, Sister Hubbard, that's Tacy Hubbard, Sister Mumford, that's Ann Mumford, and Sister Rachel Langworthy, who is the daughter of Samuel and Tacy Hubbard. This occurred on December 23rd, 1671, old style, that is the old calendar. It was January the 3rd, 1672, on the Gregorian calendar. But again, at that time, they were still using the Julian calendar. One of the greatest finds during this period of time was the actual minutes from the Sabbatarian church. There are three minute books of minutes. The oldest one is in the middle. The oldest one actually dates from 1692. The reason it doesn't go back further is that there was a fire that destroyed the other minutes prior to that. And everything is recorded here. It's wonderful to read. I had full access to this. You can't get access to it anymore. I was able to go through and write and actually take pictures of various pages. Inside this old book, you have the introduction to it. Says it's the minutes of the church keeping the commandments, is what it calls itself, and beginning in 1692. Then you have inside, you have a list of members. Now, on the slide I'm showing you, on one side, someone has reproduced it, a handwritten copy. On the other side is the original copy from 1707 of church members. You'll notice the left column is of the men and the right column is of the women. Notice how many more women. There are actually 12 men listed here and 30 women as members of the church in 1707. Again, women much more religious than we see their husbands were. There are two, Rachel Langworthy, still alive in 1707. And we also notice this person here, and I'm going to talk a little more about her. You see the name Freelove Barker. Now, who on earth would name their daughter Freelove Barker? Well, Abigail Barker is the one who named her daughter that. Abigail was a church member, but she was not a very good church member. And if you missed church more than two Sabbaths in a row, you would get a letter of admonition as to why you weren't at church. And if you continued to miss services three Sabbaths in a row, the elders would show up and want to know why at your home. Abigail Barker lived on Martha's Vineyard. She had to take a ferry boat, she had to take a carriage, and had to travel several hours to get to Newport for services. But she was still expected to be there. So here is what's called a letter of admonition written to Abigail Barker from the church, March the 15th, notice 1729/30. Again, remember, New Year's Day of the Julian calendar is March 25th. So depending on which calendar, this was either 1729 or 1730. So again, that's the reason for the split there. This is what the letter of reprimand says. It says to Abigail Barker, remember, this is the mother of Free Love Barker. She was evidently a little difficult, but says to Abigail Barker from our church meeting, March 15th, 1729/30. Whereas you were laid under admonition for your evil course of life in keeping bad company and drinking to excess and neglecting to attend God's public worship. So Abigail received a letter of admonition for her failure to attend services every Sabbath. They were truly committed to being a part, to worshiping on the Sabbath, and they had a lot of dedication about that. Some of the famous members of the time were Samuel Ward. Samuel Ward was also a governor of Rhode Island during the Revolutionary War. In fact, Samuel Ward signed what was called the Document of Secrecy. He was one of the representatives from Rhode Island to the Continental Congress where the Declaration of Independence was being drawn up. And in November of 1775, there was this Document of Secrecy. You'll notice all of those who signed, John Hancock and others who also signed the Declaration of Independence. Samuel Ward had a unique signature. He signed it Sam Ward. And this is his signature on what was known as the Document of Secrecy in November of 1775. He died that winter from smallpox. Smallpox spread through the city of Philadelphia, and he caught smallpox and died before he could sign the Declaration of Independence, or he would have been a signer. Now, I've searched the records, and Samuel Ward, there's no baptismal record for him. And I believe, my personal opinion, is because they denounced politics, that as Samuel Ward, who was very involved in politics, was the governor, was not baptized during all of those years. And there's nothing on his headstone that mentions it, but he was a Sabbath keeper during that period of time and certainly attended church. His father also was a Sabbath keeper and also attended church. He was Richard Ward. But on Richard Ward's headstone, it says that his wife was a member for 55 years. It never mentions him. His baptismal record is well after he left politics. He was also a governor. So here's Richard Ward and Samuel Ward's graves. Now, the church, the Sabbath keepers, moved out to western Rhode Island to an area called Westerly. And by 1710, this was the largest congregation, certainly of Sabbath keepers, in the New World. They had over 2,000 members out in Westerly, Rhode Island, which, of course, was right on the border with Connecticut, where many of the individuals from Connecticut would come over and worship there in Westerly, Rhode Island. There's also a story about a bridge there because the Sabbatarians coming across to observe services had to cross a bridge. But we know that 3,000 of them were baptized in the Pawcatuck River, nearby where the church actually met. So, again, it was a very large group. If you go to southern Rhode Island, even today, there's a lot of influence from the Sabbath keepers. The Sabbath keepers were a large part of southern Rhode Island during the colonial days. This is the bridge I spoke about, Boom Bridge. There was no bridge there. This is the bridge there today. It's closed off. But during the days when people would come to services in Rhode Island and had to cross the Pawcatuck River, rather than walking further downstream or upstream to find a bridge, they crossed here. There was no bridge here. And they did it on a boom. They had a tree felled, and they would put someone on the end of the tree, tie it off, and swing them around to get them across the river. And in the church minutes, it mentions several times that someone showed up late for church, dripping wet, because they had fallen off Boom Bridge. Pretty typical. The meeting house was on a hillside just outside Westerly. This is where the meeting house stood in 1680. It was moved over the years. It burned down. It was moved later on, rebuilt and moved later on. They also have the pastors buried over the years, beginning in 1680, around this statue. It's called the Minister's Monument. But this was the location of services. Also, a big part of the history, this is the gate for Brown University. A lot of people don't know that Brown was founded with seven members. Four were Sabbath keepers, and three were Sunday keepers that founded Brown. You would never know that Brown today was actually founded by the majority of Sabbath keepers as to be a university to train young people in religion in the New World. It's very different today. It was called Rhode Island College back then. It later was moved to this place on a piece of property donated by Nicholas Brown and renamed Brown University one of the Ivy League schools today. The first president of Brown University was James Manning, who was a member of the Sabbatarian Church. He was a Sabbath keeper. I found a lot of good material at, I found the journal of Samuel Hubbard, which everybody thought was lost. I discovered it not at, this is the John Hay Library on the campus of Brown, but at the Rockefeller Library, also on the campus of Brown University, discovered a copy of Samuel Hubbard's journal, which is a very important document for historical research. The Rhode Island Capitol is a marvelous place. It's the only state capitol that's made completely out of marble. It's made out of Georgia marble. And on the top of the Capitol, you can't quite see it very well, there is a statue. The statue is of what is called the free man, or actually the independent man is the name of it. And it looks like sort of a Roman or a Greek with a loincloth and has a spear in his hand, indicating the freedom and the independence of the Rhode Island people of the colony. And certainly it offered freedom of religion. A few years ago, a member sent me this sign located in New Jersey, because from Rhode Island, the Sabbatarians spread to New Jersey, to Pennsylvania, out to Iowa, and then out to Oregon, where, of course, we pick up the story with Herbert Armstrong. But notice this. There's a town called Quibbletown. Notice what it says. A colonial hamlet, which was so named because of dissension as to whether Saturday or Sunday is the Sabbath. So that's the sign as you go into this little town called Quibbletown. But the Sabbath truth spread, the members spread, but it all began in the New World in Newport, Rhode Island. Let's go back to where we started and let's conclude this story. As I said, it's a small slice of the history of what has happened, those that have gone before. Matthew 16, verse 18 again, where Christ said, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades or the grave shall not prevail against it." We believe that's true. We believe that prophecy's been fulfilled. The church has existed down through the ages. Well, I hope you've enjoyed my story. I hope it has some meaning for you, that you're able to get something from it. It's an interesting story. It's one that I'm interested in. I should say I'm interested in it. I've always felt that if I speak about something I'm interested in, it'll be more helpful and profitable for those who hear it. I hope this has been helpful. I hope it's been profitable. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's my story, my personal story of what I did back in the, mostly in the 1980s. I refer back to the scripture I gave you early on and the disclaimer I gave in 2 Timothy 2, where we're told that God knows those who are His. God certainly knows those who were truly a part of the church and those who may not have been. But the Sabbath truth identifies a thread that goes from France to England to the New World. And that's the story I wanted to tell. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got something out of it. I'm very happy to present it. It's something I've done many, many times over the years. And I want to, again, certainly appreciate the opportunity to do it. And hopefully you got something out of it.